I read about a memo that was sent round the staff in a particular office. They were told they were going to have an official staff photograph. And so everybody was to come nicely dressed on a particular day. So the day came and everybody was dressed and looked their very best. A few days later, the official photograph was produced and seen for the first time. "Not bad," said one, and the photo was passed around and everybody had a look. But one person says, "I think it does everyone justice." And the woman beside him sighed and said, "I don't want justice, I want mercy." So you notice, like with photographs, sometimes when you see yourself in a photograph, you think, "Oh dear, am I that cross looking? Am I that old looking? Am I that poor looking? Am I that shape?" You know, you think, you wish you could get it onto a computer and doctor it a little bit and make it look a little bit different. Many of us would want mercy rather than justice. And that brings us to this particular passage that we read together in John's Gospel, beginning at the end of John chapter 7, but particularly that story in John chapter 8. Let me just remind you of those opening verses. "Then each went to his own home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say?' They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him." Now, let me deal with one problem issue before we get into the passage, because if you have a New International Version of the Bible in front of you, or indeed the text of your pulpit Bible here, it reminds us that the earliest and most reliable manuscripts do not have this section. And for that reason, some commentators over the years have said this story shouldn't be in the Bible at all, that it's a man-made story, it's not a factual one. And so we should set it aside. And if you want to go through all the different arguments about it, get yourself a good commentary in John's Gospel and you'll see what the arguments are. For my part, I accept what most Gospel scholars say, that the story is hereby right and ought to be taken as true, and a very fascinating story it is. There was Jesus once again into the temple. Before this, he'd been there, and the scribes and Pharisees had sent along temple guards to arrest him, but they hadn't arrested him. They'd been overwhelmed by his person. They'd gone back to the leader, said, "No one spoke as this man speaks." And so he hadn't been arrested, and everyone had gone to their own home, but Jesus had returned the next day to the temple to continue teaching the people. And when he was there, engaged in this task, if you can picture it in your mind's eye, a group of men pushed through the crowd, dragging this woman with them. The men were Pharisees and teachers of the law, we're told. Those who are recognized as some of the most holy men around, and the most religious of men, very strict in their observance of the Old Testament law, very pernickety in their interpretation of it. And they brought this woman along, asking their question, hoping to trap Jesus. The woman, we're told, had been caught in the act of adultery. And of course, the Old Testament was very clear about this. Such a woman was to be put to death. It was one of the many different situations where the death penalty was expected to be applied. But what would Jesus say? For Jesus to say the woman should not be stoned to death would be for him to go against what the Old Testament law said. And for the Pharisees, that would have been a godsend, because then they would have caught him out and they would have found that he wasn't a true Jew at all, wasn't a true believer in the Old Testament. But for Jesus to say the Old Testament is correct, stone her to death, that would be against the Roman law, because by Roman law, the Jews were not allowed to execute anyone. So either way, Jesus was in trouble, whatever way he answered. They would have caught him in their trap. Now, we're told at first Jesus said nothing. Reading again from verse 6. "But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger." And we're not told what he wrote, And there's been hundreds of pages written about what he might have written. We're not sure, but wouldn't we love to know what he did right on the ground? He wrote with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Now, I'm sure you can picture that very tense scene. The crowd who had been there listening to Jesus teaching, this crowd of men, very holy men coming in, the woman, Jesus, you can picture the scene. And I'm sure all eyes were fixed on Jesus at this point, with him writing on the ground and then straightening himself up. And when you think about it, the hypocrisy, the sheer hypocrisy of these men, because these were the men who were planning to murder Jesus. These were the men who had such hatred in their hearts against Jesus. These men with murder in their hearts were coming along, bringing this woman, dragging her along. She'd been guilty of far less than they were guilty of. And yet they were dragging her along and wanting Jesus to condemn her. And they were just using her as a kind of pawn in their deadly game. So what happened next? Verse 9 of this. Those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first, until only Jesus was left and the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Why did the men withdraw, slinking away one by one? Was it that perhaps they began to feel ashamed of their actions? Was it because Jesus had got the better of them and they realized they had nothing more to say? Either way, it was a humiliating defeat for these men who thought they'd caught Jesus in this trap of their words. Now, that's the story. You can picture it in your mind's eye. I think it leaves us in no doubt about at least three things. Firstly, it tells us something about Jesus' attitude towards people drawn into sin. I remember all those years ago when I was still assistant minister in a church in Belfast, talking to an alcoholic who was a member of the congregation, a fringe member of the congregation, who'd become a Christian, actually. He told me a story. He started to drink simply to pass himself. He was in business. It was just social drinking. It was no problem to him at first. And then he got to a point where it became a problem to him. It became more than just social drinking. Instead of him controlling his drinking was now controlling him. And I can remember him telling me, "I never meant it to get like that. I never meant to hurt my wife and my family. I never meant it to affect my job. I never meant it to destroy my health. But in the end, it affected all these things. His wife, his family, he lost his job, his health declined. In the end, he died with cirrhosis of the liver." He said, "I just got drawn into it gradually." And isn't that the way the devil entices every one of us into different kinds of sin? It might be the sin of some kind of addiction. It might be sexual sin, as the woman's case here in this story. It might be the love of money. It might be anything. But he kind of leads us in gradually so that one thing leads to another, step by step by step, until we're caught. We find ourselves drawn down a road that we wouldn't have chosen for ourselves. We never meant to be on, but we're there. And we suddenly look back and realize that we're there. And you know, it could be any one of us in any kind of sin, because that's the way the devil works. He's so subtle, he's so clever, he's so deceptive. He makes dangerous things seem innocent to us. That's the way he works. Now, what this story tells us, I believe, is that Jesus understands this is the world we live in. We are weak, vulnerable people. He understands us and he feels for us. He has a heart of compassion towards a woman caught in adultery, And someone like you and me caught in whatever our kind of sin might happen to be. And he wants to do for us what he wanted to do for her, which was to reach out to help her and to help us, to forgive her and to forgive us, to restore her and to restore us. That lovely verse in John's Gospel is so important. God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. And so isn't that good to know? This is the attitude of our God, our Saviour, towards people like you and me who are so easily caught up into sinful things, sinful thoughts, sinful words, sinful action. So easily the devil gets us caught in a way of life. And Jesus understands, he has compassion, and he's willing to help us, and he's willing to forgive us. He doesn't come to condemn us, but to save us. Isn't that good news? Something else this story leaves us in no doubt about, that our attitude to people can very often be wrong. I have a poster in my study. It shows a man on a tiny little desert island, and he's surrounded by crocodiles. So you can picture that in your mind's eye. And what he's doing is he's picking up a lump of earth from the ground and throwing it at the crocodile. And what the caption says underneath is, "Mud thrown is ground lost." And you can picture that every time he takes up a lump of earth, his little island is getting smaller. He's throwing it at the crocodile, the little island's getting smaller all the time. Mud thrown is ground lost. And sadly, we have to confess that very often we're people who throw mud, not at crocodiles, but at other people. We're so quick to criticize and find fault with other people, aren't we? We do this. We can see their sins so very, very clearly, those awful sins. Just the way these men saw the sins of this woman so clearly, they couldn't see their own sins. And we're like that too. We can see other people's sins and we can be very, very quick to condemn them, throw mud at them, say all kinds of things about them, talk about them behind their back. We can be so self-righteous, so judgmental. But as someone has said, blowing out the other person's candle doesn't make our candle shine more brightly. Remember what Jesus himself said, Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." Now I wonder, do we need to take a good, hard look at ourselves? Are we like the teachers of the law and the Pharisees in this story? Would we be quick to drag other people and draw people's attention to them and say, look at what they've done, look at what they are? And all this at the same time, covering up the sins in our own lives, which may not be as obvious, but may be just as bad. This is a story that teaches us that our attitudes to other people can very often be un-Christ-like. Yes, even those of us who say we are Christians. The third thing I think this story makes very plain is that Jesus doesn't ever make light of or condone sin. Yes, for sure, Jesus didn't want to condemn this woman. He showed mercy to her. She was humiliated, totally humiliated by this situation. And Jesus didn't want to make it any worse for her. He showed mercy to her. He didn't condemn her. But look at what he did say to her. When everyone else had disappeared, he spoke to her just privately and said, "Go now and leave your life of sin." So he wasn't overlooking her sin. He wasn't saying that this didn't matter, what she was doing, the kind of lifestyle she had. He wasn't saying that. The woman needed to acknowledge her sin. She needed to forsake it. And then she'd be able to rejoice in God's forgiveness and make a new beginning. go now and leave your life of sin. Those were Jesus' words to the woman that day. And maybe they're the same words that he's speaking into our hearts and lives as well. Are there things that we know are wrong in our lives? Are we willing to acknowledge them? And not just acknowledge them, but to forsake them. That's the key thing, isn't it? Easy to confess and just say, God, forgive me for this, that, the other thing. Literally, to confess sin is to say what God says about it. It's something that's horrible. It's something that's repulsive. And because it's repulsive, we should want to get away from it. And so we've got to listen to what God says to us about our sin and do what he says, which is to get rid of it, forsake it. And you know, we've been thinking about the Christmas story. Of course we have, all over Christmas. It's very easy to get caught up in that story, the kind of sentimentality of it, the baby in the manger and these people coming to bring their gifts and so on. And love came down at Christmas. It's all a very sentimental kind of thing. It's a message of love, we might say. And yet, behind it all, we must not forget that Jesus came into the world to die on a cross for sin. And he wouldn't have done that if sin had not been a serious thing. Because it's a serious sin, he wants you and me to be rid of it and not hold on to it. And that's why he says, go now and leave your life of sin. It's a remarkable story, isn't it? One that's easy for us to picture in our mind's eye. Some very pertinent lessons. But then it's followed on in John's Gospel by this memorable saying of Jesus. Words that you'll be very familiar with in verse 12. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, remember what's been happening in Jerusalem and in the temple. During these past days, Jesus has been teaching the people. It's been a very important time of the year. They've been celebrating the Feast of the Tabernacles, Harvest Thanksgiving season, so lots of people about. When, among other things, they remembered how the Lord had led them in years past through the wilderness, as Moses led the children of Israel, leading them by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. You remember that story? And at this time of the Feast of Tabernacles, the seven-branched candelabra was lit, called the menorah. It was all a very important time in the temple. It reminded everyone who came to the temple of the light of God's presence through those dark days of pilgrimage through the desert. And here was Jesus now picking up on this theme of light shining in the temple and saying, I am the light of the world. A world then that was caught up in the darkness of ignorance and sinfulness and despair, and a world that hasn't changed today either. And here was Jesus fulfilling that prophecy that I'm sure was read for you in one of your carol services, where Isaiah talks about the people living in darkness have seen a great light. And then goes on to talk about, for now to us a son is given, and so on. The prophecy that the light of the world was coming, and Jesus now is that light of the world. And so one of the commentators says, in spite of all the disciplines of art and science, the vast majority of people neither see nor understand the value of their souls, the true nature of God, nor the reality of the world to come. That's how dark this world is. People do not see the value of their souls. They do not see the true nature of God, nor do they see the reality of the world to come. That's how dark this world is. Darkness covers the earth, whether people see and understand it or not. Spiritual truth, people are just ignorant, so ignorant to it nowadays, increasingly so. But the good news is our Lord Jesus is the light of the world, come to dispel darkness. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And so to the ignorant, he brings his wisdom, the wisdom of God. To the failed, like this woman, he brings forgiveness. To the impure, he brings holiness. To the weak, he brings strength. To the aimless, he brings direction. To the heartbroken, he brings healing. To the despairing, he brings hope. Light into the darkness of people's particular situation. And what he's saying is that if you and I commit ourselves to following him, then we'll never walk in darkness, but we'll have the light of life with us. We'll have him with us. Now, don't misunderstand that. That doesn't mean that there won't possibly be some dark days ahead for us, because for all of us, there are dark days to face in life. There is sickness. There is disease. There is death. There are problems. Of course there are. Doesn't mean that all problems are taken out of life, but it does mean that in those dark days, his light still shines for us. We have light that others do not have. The light of his presence, the light of his gospel, the light of his hope, the light of the future, the light of a compassionate, caring Savior. Some of you may know the story about Alexander the Great, famous leader of Greek Empire. Many years ago, there was a blockbuster film some years ago entitled Alexander the Great. You may have seen it. I read this about him. Alexander the Great was the regent of Macedonia at the age of 16, a victorious general at 18, a king at 20. He died before he was 33, having conquered the then known world. His father was Philip of Macedon, also a military genius who invented the famous Greek phalanx, that solid formation of heavily armed infantry soldiers. When Alexander was in his early teens, a seller of horses offered to sell Alexander's father his horse Bucephalus, a trained but vicious animal. Philip took his son along to see the horse, to see it go through its paces, but the stallion proved so unmanageable that none of the men could even mount him. Alexander noted that he seemed to be afraid of his own shadow. So he quietened the horse by turning its head towards the sun. Then Alexander mounted the horse and by keeping him headed towards the sun, got him under control. And it then became his horse. And there's a little lesson in that. It's when we face ourselves in the direction of the sun, not so much S-U-N as S-O-N, when we face ourselves in the direction of the one who is the Son of Light, then he's the one who deals with all our fears. Might be our fear of loneliness, might be our fear of rejection, it might be our fear of failure, might be our fear of death, whatever. He's the one who deals with our fears and gives us an assurance, a peace and a joy that no one else can bring. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. What a message for all of us as we come to the end of 1 year, beginning of another year very soon. Are we following Jesus? Have we already committed our life to him? Are we following him day by day? Are we learning from him? Are we seeking to live a life that's pleasing to him? I trust that so. But if you're someone who has not yet committed your life to Jesus Christ, it's time you had. I don't know how many funerals we've had this past 2 weeks, but a significant number, all ages, reminding us that none of us is sure even of tomorrow. So who would face the prospect of tomorrow without having the certainty of Christ in their life? It's a foolish thing to do, is it not? If you're someone who has not yet committed your life to Christ, I would urge you now to do that. To choose that you will follow him and to believe his promise that as you follow him, you will never again walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. May God enable us all so to do.